struck dumb by his gallantry. His hair was a mass of lazy brown curls, his eyes like liquid gold. She inhaled the sweet fragrance of the rose, and sat clutching it long after Sir Loras had ridden off. When Sansa finally looked up, a man was standing over her staring. He was short, with a pointed beard and a silver streak in his hair, almost as old as her father. "You must be one of her daughters," he said to her. He had grey-green eyes that did not smile when his mouth did. "You have the Tully look." "I am Sansa Stark," she said, ill at ease. The man wore a heavy cloak with a fur collar, fastened with a silver mockingbird, and he had the effortless manner of a high lord. But she did not know him. "I have not had the honour, my lord." Septa Mordaunt quickly took a hand. "Sweet child, this is Lord Petar Baelish, of the King's Small Council." "Your mother was my queen of beauty once," the man said quietly. His breath smelled of mint. "You have her hair." His fingers brushed against her cheek as he stroked one auburn lock. Quite abruptly he turned and walked away. By then the moon was well up, and the crowd was tired, so the king decreed that the last three matches would be fought the next morning before the melee. While the commons began their walk home, talking of the day's jousts and the matches to come on the morrow, the court moved to the riverside to begin the feast. Six monstrous huge aurochs had been roasting for hours, turning slowly on wooden spits, while kitchen boys basted them with butter and herbs until the meat crackled and spit. Tables and benches had been raised outside the pavilions, piled high with sweet grass and strawberries and fresh baked bread. Sansa and Septa Mordaunt were given places of high honour to the left of the raised dais, where the king himself sat beside his queen. When Prince Joffrey seated himself to her right, she felt her throat tighten. He had not spoken a word to her since the awful thing had happened, and she had not dared to speak to him. At first she thought she hated him for what they'd done to Lady, but after Sansa had wept her eyes dry, she told herself it had not been Joffrey's doing, not truly. The queen had done it. She was the one to hate, her and Arya. Nothing bad would have happened except for Arya. She could not hate Joffrey tonight. He was too beautiful to hate. He wore a deep blue doublet studded with a double row of golden lion's heads, and around his brow a slim coronet made of gold and sapphires. His hair was as bright as a metal. Sansa looked at him and trembled, afraid he might ignore her or worse, turn hateful again, and send her weeping from the table. Instead, Joffrey smiled and kissed her hand, handsome and gallant as any prince in the songs, and said, "Sir Loras has a keen eye for beauty, sweet lady." "He was too kind," she demurred, trying to remain modest and calm, though her heart was singing. "Sir Loras is a true knight. Do you think he will win tomorrow, my lord?" "No," Geoffrey said. "My dog will do for him, or perhaps my uncle Jaime. And in a few years, when I'm old enough to enter the lists, I shall do for them all." He raised his hand to summon a servant with a flagon of iced summer wine and poured her a cup. She looked anxiously at Septa Mordaunt, until Joffrey leaned over and filled the Septa's cup as well. So she nodded and thanked him graciously and said not another word. The servants kept their cups filled all night, yet afterwards Sansa could not recall ever tasting the wine. She needed no wine. She was drunk on the magic of that night, giddy with glamour, swept away by beauty she had dreamt of all her life and never dared hope to know. Singers sat before the king's pavilion, filling the dusk with music. A juggler kept a cascade of burning clubs spinning through the air. The king's own fool, the pie-faced simpleton called Moonboy, danced about on stilts, all in motley, making mock of everyone with such deft cruelty that Sansa wondered if he was simple after all. Even Septa Mordaunt was helpless before him. When he sang his little song about the High Septon, she laughed so loud she spilled wine on herself. And Joffrey was the soul of courtesy. He talked to Sansa all night, showering her with compliments, making her laugh, sharing little bits of court gossip, explaining Moon Boy's japes. Sansa was so captivated that she quite forgot all her courtesies and ignored Septa Mordain seated to her left. All the while the courses came and went, a thick soup of barley and venison, salads of sweet grass and spinach and plums sprinkled with crushed nuts, snails in honey and garlic. Sansa had never eaten snails before. Joffrey showed her how to get the snail out of the shell and fed her the first sweet morsel himself. Then came trout, fresh from the river, baked in clay. Her prince helped her crack open the hard casing to expose the flaky, white flesh within. And when the meat course was brought out, he served to himself, slicing a queen's portion from the joint, smiling as he laid it on her plate. She could see from the way he moved that his right arm was still troubling him, yet he uttered not a word of complaint. Later came sweetbreads and pigeon pie and baked apples fragrant with cinnamon and lemon cakes frosted in sugar, but by then Sansa was so stuffed that she could not manage more than two little lemon cakes, as much as she loved them. She was wondering whether she might attempt a third, when the king began to shout. King Robert had grown louder with each course. From time to time Sansa could hear him laughing or roaring a command over the music and the clangor of plates and cutlery, but they were too far away for her to make out his words. Now everyone heard him. "No!" he thundered, in a voice that drowned out all other speech. Sansa was shocked to see the king on his feet, red of face, reeling. He had a goblet of wine in one hand, and he was drunk as a man could be. "You do not tell me what to do, woman," he screamed at Queen Cersei. "I am king here. Do you understand? I rule here, and if I say that I will fight tomorrow, I will fight." Everyone was staring. Sansa saw Sir Barristan and the king's brother Renly, and the short man who had talked to her so oddly and touched her hair. But no one made a move to interfere. The queen's face was a mask, so bloodless that it might have been sculpted from snow. She rose from the table, gathered her skirts around her, and stormed off in silence, servants trailing behind. Jaime Lannister put a hand on the king's shoulder, but the king shoved him away hard. Lannister stumbled and fell. The king guffawed. "The great knight! I can still knock you in the dirt. Remember that, Kingslayer?" He slapped his chest with his jeweled goblet, splashing wine all over his satin tunic. "Give me my hammer, and not a man in the realm can stand before me." Jaime Lannister rose and brushed himself off. "As you say, Your Grace." His voice was stiff. Lord Renly came forward, smiling. "You've spilled your wine, Robert. Let me fetch you a fresh goblet." Sansa started as Joffrey laid a hand on her arm. "It grows late," the prince said. He had a queer look in his face, as if he were not seeing her at all. "Do you need an escort back to the castle?" "No," Sansa began. She looked for Septa Mordain and was startled to find her with her head on the table, snoring soft and ladylike snores. "I mean to say, yes, thank you, that would be most kind. I am tired, and the way is so dark, I should be glad for some protection." Joffrey called out, "Dog!" Sandor Clegane seemed to take form out of the night, so quickly did he appear. He had exchanged his armor for a red woolen tunic with a leather dog's head sewn on the front. The light of the torches made his burned face shine a dull red. "Yes, Your Grace," he said. "Take my betrothed back to the castle, and see that no harm befalls her," the prince told him brusquely, and without even a word of farewell, Joffrey strode off, leaving her there. Sansa could feel the hound watching her. "Did you think Joff was going to take you himself?" he laughed. He had a laugh like the snarling of dogs in a pit. "Small chance of that." He pulled her unresisting to her feet. "Come, you're not the only one who needs sleep. I've drunk too much, and I may need to kill my brother tomorrow." He laughed again. Suddenly terrified, Sansa pushed at Septa Mordain's shoulder, hoping to wake her, but she only snored the louder. King Robert had stumbled off, and half the benches were suddenly empty. The feast was over, and the beautiful dream had ended with it. The Hound snatched up a torch to light their way. Sansa followed close beside him. The ground was rocky and uneven. The flickering light made it seem to shift and move beneath her. She kept her eyes lowered, watching where she placed her feet. They walked among the pavilions, each with its banner and its armor hung outside, the silence weighing heavier with every step. Sansa could not bear the sight of him. He frightened her so. Yet she had been raised in all the ways of courtesy. A true lady would not notice his face, she told herself. "You rode gallantly today, Sir Sandor," she made herself say. Sandor Clegane snarled at her. "Spare me your empty little compliments, girl. And your sirs. I'm no knight. I spit on them, and their vows. My brother is a knight. Did you see him ride today?" "Yes," Sansa whispered, trembling. "He was gallant," the Hound finished. He was mocking her, she realized. No one could withstand him, she managed at last, proud of herself. It was no lie. Sandor Clegane stopped suddenly in the middle of a dark and empty field. She had no choice but to stop beside him. "Some scepter trained you well. You're like one of those birds from the Summer Isles, aren't you? Pretty little talking bird, repeating all the pretty little words they taught you to recite." "That's unkind." Sansa could feel her heart fluttering in her chest. "You're frightening me. I want to go now." "No one could withstand him," the Hound rasped. "That's truth enough. No one could ever withstand Gregor. That boy today, his second joust, oh, that was a pretty bit of business. You saw that, did you? Fool boy, he had no business riding in this company. No money, no squire, no one to help him with his armor. That gorget wasn't fastened proper. You think Gregor didn't notice that? You think Sir Gregor's lance rode up by chance, do you? Pretty little talking girl, you believe that. You're empty-headed as a bird for true. Gregor's lance goes where Gregor wants it to go. Look at me, look at me!" Sandor Clegane put a huge hand on her chin and forced her face up. He squatted in front of her and moved the torch close. "There's pretty for you. Take a good long stare. You know you want to. I've watched you turning away all the way down the King's Road. Piss on that. Take your look." His fingers held her jaw as hard as an iron trap. His eyes watched hers, drunken eyes, sullen with anger. She had to look. The right side of his face was gaunt, with sharp cheekbones and a grey eye beneath a heavy brow. His nose was large and hooked, his hair thin, dark. He wore it long and brushed it sideways because no hair grew on the other side of that face. The left side of his face was a ruin. His ear had been burned away. There was nothing left but a hole. His eye was still good, but all around it was a twisted mass of scar, slick black flesh, hard as leather, pocked with craters and fissured by deep cracks that gleamed red and wet when he moved. Down by his jaw, you could see the hint of bone where the flesh had been seared away. Sansa began to cry. He let go of her then, and snuffed out the torch in the dirt. "No pretty words for that, girl. No little compliment the scepter taught you." When there was no answer, he continued, "Most of them. They think it was some battle. A siege, a burning tower, an enemy with a torch. One fool asked me if it was dragon's breath." His laugh was softer this time, but just as bitter. "I'll tell you what it was, girl," he said, in a voice from the night, a shadow leaning so close now that she could smell the sour stench of wine on his breath. "I was younger than you, 6, maybe 7. a woodcarver set up shop in the village under my father's keep, and to buy a favour, he sent us gifts. The old man made marvellous toys. I don't remember what I got, but it was Gregor's gift I wanted. A wooden knight all painted up, every joint pegged separate, and fixed with strings, so you can make him fight. Gregor is 5 years older than me. The toy was nothing to him. He was already a squire, 6 feet tall and muscled like an ox. So I took his knight. But there was no joy in it, I tell you. I was scared all the while, and true enough, he found me. There was a brazier in the room. Gregor never said a word, just picked me up under his arm and shoved the side of my face down on the burning coals and held me there, while I screamed and screamed. You saw how strong he is. Even then, it took 3 grown men to drag him off me. The septons preach about the 7 hells. What do they know? Only a man who's been burned knows what hell is truly like. My father told everyone my bedding had caught fire, and our maester gave me ointments. Ointments? Gregor got his ointments, too. 4 years later, they anointed him with the 7 oils, and he recited his nightly vows, and Rhaegar Targaryen tapped him on his shoulder and said, "Arise, Sir Gregor." The rasping voice trailed off. He squatted silently before her, a hulking black shape, shrouded in night, hidden from her eyes. Sansa could hear his ragged breathing. She was sad for him, she realized. Somehow the fear had gone away. The silence went on and on, so long that she began to grow afraid once more. But she was afraid for him now, not for herself. She found his massive shoulder with her hand. "He was no true knight," she whispered to him. The hound threw back his head and roared. Sansa stumbled back away from him, but he caught her arm. "No," he growled her. "No, little bird, he was no true knight." The rest of the way into the city, Sandor Clegane said not a word. He led her to where the carts were waiting, told a driver to take them back to the Red Keep, and climbed in after her. They rode in silence through the King's Gate and up torch-lit city streets. He opened the postern door and led her into the castle, his burned face twitching and his eyes brooding, and he was one step behind her as they climbed the tower stairs. He took her safe all the way to the corridor outside her bedchamber. "Thank you, my lord," Sansa said meekly. The hound caught her by the arm and leaned close. "The things I told you tonight," he said, his voice sounding even rougher than usual. "If you ever tell Joffrey, your sister, your father, any of them—"
"I won't," Sansa whispered. I promise."
It was not enough.
"If you ever tell anyone," he finished, "I'll kill you."
Eddard. "I stood last vigil for him myself," Sir Barristan Selmy said, as they looked down at the body in the back of the cart. "He had no one else. A mother in the Vale, I'm told." In the pale dawn light, the young knight looked as though he were sleeping. He had not been handsome, but death had smoothed his rough-hewn features, and the Silent Sisters had dressed him in his best velvet tunic, with a high collar, to cover the ruin the lance had made of his throat. Eddard Stark looked at his face and wondered if it had been for his sake that the boy had died. Slain by a Lannister bannerman before Ned could speak to him? Could that be mere happenstance? He supposed he would never know. "Hugh was John Arryn's squire for 4 years," Selmy went on. "The king knighted him before he rode north in John's memory. The lad wanted it desperately, yet I fear he was not ready.
Ned had slept badly last night, and he felt tired beyond his years. "None of us is ever ready," he said.
"For knighthood?"
"For death." Gently, Ned covered the boy with his cloak, a blood-stained bit of blue, bordered in crescent moons. When his mother asked why her son was dead, he reflected bitterly, they would tell her they'd fought to honour the king's hand, Eddard Stark. This was needless. "War should not be a game," Ned turned to the woman beside the cart, shrouded in grey, face hidden, but for her eyes. The Silent Sisters prepared men for the grave, and it was ill fortune to look on the face of death. "Send his armour home to the Vale. The mother will want to have it."
"It is worth a fair piece of silver," Sir Barristan said. "The boy had it forged special for the tourney. Plain work, but good. I do not know if he had finished paying the smith."
"He paid yesterday, my lord, and he paid dearly," Ned replied. And to the Silent Sister he said, "Send the mother the armour. I will deal with this smith." She bowed her head. Afterwards, Sir Barristan walked with Ned to the king's pavilion. The camp was beginning to stir. Fat sausages sizzled and spit over fire pits, spicing the air with a sense of garlic and pepper. Young squires hurried about on errands as their masters woke, yawning and stretching to meet the day. A serving man with a goose under his arm bent his knee when he caught sight of them.
"My lords,"
he muttered, as the goose honked and pecked at his fingers. The shields displayed outside each tent heralded its occupant. The silver eagle, a sea god. Bryce Caron's field of nightingales. A cluster of grapes for the red wines. Brindle boar, red ox, burning tree, white ram, triple spiral, purple unicorn, dancing maiden, black adder, twin towers, horned owl, and last, the pure white blazons of the king's guard, shining like the dawn.
"The king means to fight in the melee today," Sir Barristan said, as they were passing Sir Meron's shield, its pane solid by a deep gash where Loras Tyrell's lance had scarred the wood as he drove him from his saddle.
"Yes," Ned said grimly. Jory had woken him last night to bring him that news. Small wonder he had slept so badly. Sir Barristan's look was troubled.
"They say night's beauties fade at dawn, and the children of wine are oft disowned in the morning light."
"They say so," Ned agreed, "but not of Robert. Other men might reconsider words spoken in drunken bravado, but Robert Baratheon would remember, and remembering would never back down." The king's pavilion was close by the water, and the morning mists of the river had wreathed it in wisps of grey. It was all of golden silk, the largest and grandest structure in the camp. Outside the entrance, Robert's war hammer was displayed beside an immense iron shield blazoned with the crown stag of House Baratheon. Ned had hoped to discover the king still abed in a wine-soaked sleep, but luck was not with him. They found Robert drinking beer from a polished horn and roaring his displeasure at two young squires who were trying to buckle him into his armour.
"Your Grace," one was saying, almost in tears, "it's made too small, it won't go."
He fumbled, and the gorget he was trying to fit around Robert's thick neck tumbled to the ground.
"Seven hells," Robert swore. "Do I have to do it myself? Piss on the both of you. Pick it up. Don't just stand there gaping, Lancel. Pick it up."
The lad jumped, and the king noticed his company.
"Look at these oaths, Ned. My wife insisted I take these two to squire for me, and they're worse than useless. Can't even put a man's armour on properly. Squires, they say? I say they're swineherd dressed up in silk."
Ned only needed a glance to understand the difficulty. "The boys are not at fault," he told the king. "You're too fat for your armour, Robert." Robert Baratheon took a long swallow of beer, tossed the empty horn onto his sleeping furs, wiped his mouth on the back of his hand, and said darkly, "Fat? Fat, is it? Is that how you speak to your king?" He let go his laughter, sudden as a storm. "Damn you, Ned, why are you always right?" The squire smiled nervously until the king turned on them. "You, yes, both of you. You heard the hand? The king is too fat for his armour. Go find Sir Aaron Sanigar. Tell him I need the breastplate stretcher. Now, what are you waiting for?" The boys tripped over each other in the haste to be quit of the tent. Robert managed to keep a stern face until they were gone. Then he dropped back in his chair, shaking with laughter. Sir Barristan Selmy chuckled with him. Even Eddard Stark managed a smile. Always, though, the graver thoughts crept in. He could not help taking note of the two squires. Handsome boys, fair and well-made. One was Sansa's age, with long golden curls, the other perhaps 15, sandy-haired, with a wisp of a moustache and the emerald-green eyes of the queen.